Dear Talking About Platforms listeners, this episode is part of our special AI-generated series, exploring the key ideas and influential works that have shaped platform studies. Let's get started.
Welcome to another deep dive. Today, we're going back in time, 2003 to be exact.
Oh, wow. Quite a while back.
It is, but the paper we're looking at is, it's cited all the time still today.
Yeah, it really is foundational.
Chicken and egg. Competition among intermediation service providers.
By Bernard Cahill and Bruno Julian.
That's right.
It's a good one.
It really is. And for anyone who's either studying platforms, working on them, building them, or just trying to understand them.
Absolutely.
This paper is really core to getting a lot of the fundamental concepts.
Yeah, and this is kind of one of the first papers that really lays out some of the key things that make platform competition different from just regular competition between like a couple of companies or something.
Right. And this paper is very much steeped in economics, so we're going to try to explain it in as plain language as possible.
Yeah, definitely.
So the paper kicks off with a quote from Jeff Bezos.
Back when Amazon was just books.
Right. Yeah. Back when it was just books and it was
like the very early days.
Yeah. And it really, the quote highlights what informational intermediaries do.
Right, just connecting the two sides.
Connecting the two sides of the market. But then the question is, what happens when you're starting from scratch?
Right. How do you get both sides on board?
So they run into what they call the chicken and egg problem. Right?
Exactly. Like, how do you get the chicken or the egg first? Which one comes first?
And so to sort of model this in a simplified way, they talk about two intermediaries, which they call matchmakers.
Yeah, it's a cuter way of saying it.
It is. And they're trying to attract users from two groups. Now, these could be buyers and sellers or men and women on a dating site.
Right. Any two-sided market, really.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. And so the assumption is that these two matchmakers have the same technology.
Same goals. Yeah.
So then how does one get an edge over the other?
Right. Well, that's where the pricing strategy comes in. And this is where this paper gets really interesting.
Okay.
So they have registration fees, which is what users pay just to sign up on the platform. And then they also have transaction fees, which are charged only when a successful match happens.
Okay.
Like if someone actually buys a product or finds a date or whatever the goal is.
Okay.
So the paper kind of shows how these two different types of fees can be used strategically. And one of the big takeaways that they have is this idea of divide and conquer.
Oh, interesting.
Which I'm sure you've probably heard of.
Yeah.
But, you know, it really shines in this paper. It's where it's really highlighted. And basically the idea is that you're going to subsidize one side of the market.
Okay.
Sometimes very heavily. Like you might even have negative registration fees.
Oh, wow.
So you're basically paying them to join.
Interesting. So to build that initial mass on one side to attract the other side.
Right. Exactly.
Okay, but how do they avoid just losing a ton of money?
Yeah, so that's where the constraints of their model come in, and that's actually what makes it very powerful. So, for example, they show that, you know, the prices they set, both the registration fees and the transaction fees, they have to result in a non-negative expected surplus for both the buyer and the seller side.
So both sides have to feel like they're getting some value.
Yeah, they have to be better off participating than not participating.
Right.
Even though one side is getting a huge subsidy.
Okay, so it's like a balancing act, right?
Exactly. It's like this delicate dance where you're encouraging one side to join, but you're also making sure the other side sees enough value to stick around.
So that the other side can generate the revenue, right?
Exactly. And then you can kind of make up for that subsidy that you gave to the first side.
Wow, very interesting.
Yeah. And then from there, the paper goes on to explore this other key dimension, which is exclusivity versus non-exclusivity.
Oh, right. So like the battle for user loyalty.
Yeah. Are you only allowed to be on one platform or can you play the field and be on multiple platforms?
Right, right. So what does the model say about how that choice actually impacts competition between these platforms?
Well, with exclusivity, you often see one platform just dominating. Everybody's in the same pool.
Okay, so like a specialized professional network or something.
Yeah, exactly. Where you have to be a member to participate and everyone's kind of in that same group.
So then would that mean higher profits for the platform since everyone's there?
Well, not necessarily. And this is one of the really interesting things about the paper.
Okay.
The authors argue that while exclusivity leads to these kind of dominant firm equilibria, the competition to actually become that dominant player can be so fierce that profits are actually driven down very low, maybe even to zero.
Oh, wow.
Everyone's fighting so hard to get everyone on their platform that they kind of have to give up some pricing power.
So they're giving up a lot in order to attract everyone to their platform.
Right. Exactly.
And that's in the exclusivity model.
Yeah.
So then what about when users are allowed to be on multiple platforms? So like the non-exclusivity.
Yeah. So non-exclusivity can lead to these really interesting outcomes. Sometimes it can actually be very efficient because everyone's on both platforms. So they benefit from these wider connections.
Oh, I see.
But it can also be inefficient because you have users kind of duplicating their efforts and they're not actually getting any advantage from being on multiple platforms.
Right. Right. And then what about the profit game? Does that change under non-exclusivity?
Absolutely. So the paper argues that platforms might actually make more money under non-exclusivity.
Oh, really? So more money with non-exclusivity than exclusivity?
Yeah, it's kind of counterintuitive, but the idea is that non-exclusivity can actually relax that cutthroat competition we see under exclusivity.
Oh, I see.
So by allowing users to be on multiple platforms, you're kind of lessening the pressure to be the one and only.
Okay, so less competition, potentially more profit.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. But then why would any platform choose to share the market when they could try to dominate it?
That's the key question. And that's where the paper's insights become super valuable because they're not just relying on intuition. They actually model this out formally.
Okay.
And they show that under certain conditions, sharing the market can actually be more profitable than this all-out war for exclusivity.
Oh, interesting.
So it's all about maximizing your return in the long run, even if it means accepting a smaller piece of the pie at the start.
Oh, I see. And that leads us to another crucial aspect of platform competition, the role of transaction fees.
Exactly. And that's what we'll get into next.
Okay, great. Okay. So we've explored some of these concepts in Kayo and Julian's paper. You know, the chicken and egg problem, divide and conquer pricing, and the trade-offs between exclusive and non-exclusivity.
Right.
But do these theories actually hold up in the real world?
They do. And in fact, I think this paper helps explain a lot of the successes and struggles we see in the platform economy.
Okay, I'm all ears. So like, what's a good example of this chicken and egg problem that they talk about?
So think about the early days of like ride hailing.
Okay.
Uber and Lyft.
Right.
They need drivers, they need riders.
Classic two-sided market.
Yeah, if there are no drivers, there are no rides. If there are no riders, there's no point in driving.
Right.
So how do they overcome this?
Yeah.
Well, a lot of times, they used heavy subsidies for drivers in the early days.
Okay.
Guarantees, bonuses, all sorts of things to make sure that there are always cars available.
Ah, the divide part of divide and conquer.
Right, exactly. So you attract the drivers first.
Right.
And then the riders will follow.
They did follow.
And they did. And once they have that driver network, then they can start adjusting rider pricing to find that balance between supply and demand.
Yeah, it seems like it's a textbook example of how to overcome that initial hurdle.
It really is.
And lead to that kind of massive growth.
Yeah.
Okay. So what about platforms where it's not about traditional buyers and sellers?
Okay.
Let's say content platforms. So like YouTube or Spotify.
Yeah. So there you're connecting creators with audiences.
Right.
And maybe there isn't like a direct transaction, like a purchase,
right,
but the principle still applies.
So how would divide and conquer work in those cases?
So in those cases, you know, you could think about subsidizing either the creators or the viewers. It could go both ways.
Okay.
But early on, a lot of platforms will focus on attracting creators.
Okay.
Give them a platform to reach a wider audience, maybe even monetize their content.
So like YouTube's partner program.
Yeah, exactly.
Where creators get a cut of the ad revenue.
Exactly. And that's a huge incentive.
Yeah.
Because it boosts the platform's content library and attracts more viewers.
Right.
And then on the viewer side, maybe they introduce premium features. So it's like ad-free listening, exclusive content.
Okay.
And then that revenue can help support the creator side.
So they're finding that balance, right?
Right. It's this delicate dance where you're making sure both sides feel like they're getting value, even if one side gets more benefits up front.
Gotcha. So let's move on to this idea of exclusivity versus non-exclusivity.
Right.
Kayo and Julian suggest that platforms might actually favor non-exclusivity because of higher profits, even though that might mean that they have to share the market.
Right.
And we do see that playing out in the real world,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Give me some examples.
Think about online marketplaces like Etsy.
Okay.
Or even Amazon Handmade.
Right.
A lot of sellers on these platforms, they also have their own websites or they sell through other channels.
Right.
They're not bound to that one platform.
So it's a non-exclusive model.
Exactly.
But wouldn't those marketplaces prefer to have exclusive sellers?
Well, you might think so.
Yeah.
It might seem like it would give them more control.
Right.
But they recognize that allowing these sellers to diversify actually can benefit the platform as a whole.
Oh, interesting.
It keeps the selection diverse, which attracts more buyers.
So creating that thriving ecosystem.
Right.
Instead of trying to just maximize control.
Yeah.
Makes a lot of sense. What about transaction fees? We were talking about those before. Mm. What about when transaction fees aren't even possible?
So Kao and Julian talk about this and they say, well, you know, this can actually lead to higher profits for platforms in some cases.
Okay.
But also less efficient outcomes.
Oh, interesting.
And this is where like social media gets really interesting. Yeah. Platforms like Facebook, Instagram.
Right.
They don't have these direct transactions between users.
Right.
So there's no transaction fees in the traditional sense.
Their revenue comes from advertising.
Exactly.
Oh.
And, you know, they've become incredibly profitable.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they've also struggled with controlling user behavior.
Oh, right.
Misinformation, harmful content spreading quickly.
Yeah, all that stuff.
And this is kind of the trade-off that the paper highlights.
Okay.
When you don't have these transaction fees, you have fewer levers to kind of steer user behavior in these positive directions.
So it raises questions about how do they balance profit with the broader impact of their platform, right?
Exactly. And that's a key takeaway. I mean, the paper gives us this framework for understanding the mechanics.
Right.
But it also prompts us to think about the bigger picture.
Right. The societal implications of those choices.
Yeah, absolutely. And that brings us to the question of how has the landscape of platform competition evolved since this paper was published?
Right. Because, I mean, this was 2003.
Yeah.
So much has changed.
Mobile apps, data-driven personalization, AI.
AI.
None of that was really dominant back then.
Right.
So are Kao and Julian's findings still relevant today?
Yeah, it really makes you think, you know, Kao and Julian's chicken and egg paper still resonates today, even though the platform landscape has changed so much since 2003.
I mean, that's the sign of a truly insightful work, right?
Right.
It identifies those fundamental dynamics that persist even as the technology changes.
Right.
But we can't ignore the changes either.
Right.
The rise of mobile, data-driven personalization, AI.
Yeah.
Those have definitely shifted the game.
Okay, so let's start with mobile. I mean, it's totally transformed how we interact with platforms.
Absolutely.
I mean, they're always with us, always on.
Right. And that constant connectivity has just supercharged network effects.
Oh, interesting. How so?
Well, think about it. The barriers to switching are much higher when a platform is always in your pocket.
I see.
It's not just about the number of users anymore. It's about the intensity and the frequency of interactions.
Okay. So does that make divide and conquer even more powerful then?
In some ways, yes, because mobile platforms have become incredibly sophisticated at using data to target very specific user groups.
Oh, okay.
With personalized incentives.
Oh, so it's an even more precise divide.
Exactly.
Can you give me an example of
that?
Sure.
So imagine a food delivery app
that
offers discounts to attract new customers.
Okay.
But only in a particular neighborhood.
Okay.
Or a ride-hailing service that gives bonuses to drivers, but only during peak hours.
Okay.
In a very specific area.
Oh, so they're not just dividing by user type anymore.
Right. It's much more granular.
Right. They're segmenting by location, time.
And individual preferences.
Wow. That's fascinating.
Yeah. Mobile has added this whole other layer.
To divide and conquer.
Yeah.
Okay, so what about transaction fees? Has mobile made it easier or harder for platforms to use them?
Oh, I think it's definitely made it easier.
Okay.
Think about in-app purchases, subscription services, even tipping within platforms like Uber or TaskRabbit.
Mm-hmm.
Mobile payments have made those transactions incredibly seamless.
Okay.
So it reduces friction, which makes users much more likely to spend.
So Kao and Julian's insights about the strategic use of these fees are even more relevant now.
I think so.
Than ever.
Yeah.
Okay. But mobile is only one piece of the puzzle, right? We also have to consider data-driven personalization.
Absolutely.
Platforms are collecting massive amounts of data about us, you know, our behaviors, preferences, social connections.
It's true. And they're using that data to create these very tailored experiences. The content we see, the products that are recommended to us.
Right. It's about catering to our individual needs and desires.
Exactly.
Now that sounds great for users.
It does.
But could it be impacting competition?
Yeah. I mean, it's a double-edged sword.
Oh.
On one hand, personalization can create really strong user lock-in.
Okay. How so?
If a platform knows you really, really well.
Yeah.
it can provide a level of service that competitors just can't match.
So it reinforces those network effects we were talking about before.
Exactly.
Okay, but what's the other edge of the sword?
The other edge of the sword is that personalization could actually make it easier for new platforms to disrupt the market.
Oh, how so?
Imagine a startup that uses AI to understand your needs even better than these established giants.
Oh, I see.
They can leverage that deep personalization to pull users away.
So it's like an arms race of personalization, right?
Exactly.
The incumbents are using it to defend their territory,
mm-hmm.
but the challengers are using it to try to gain a foothold.
It's a constant battle.
Wow.
Yeah. And that brings us to another significant shift since Kylo and Julian's paper. The rise of new forms of network effects.
Okay. What do you mean by new forms? Like what kinds are we seeing?
Well, traditional network effects were all about the size and density of connections.
Okay.
You know, more users means more value for everyone.
Yeah, like the classic telephone example.
Exactly. More people have telephones.
Right.
The more useful a telephone is to each individual person.
Right. So it's about those direct connections between users.
Exactly. But now we're seeing network effects that are driven by data itself.
Oh, interesting.
So the more data a platform has,
yeah.
the better its algorithms become.
Yeah.
The more effectively it can personalize experiences,
mm-hmm.
which attracts more users, which generates more data.
Right. So it's a flywheel effect.
Exactly. Data fuels growth, which generates more data.
And accelerates growth.
Exactly.
Wow. And that has huge implications for competition then. Because platforms with these massive data troves have a huge advantage.
Yeah, not just in personalization, but in things like AI development and innovation.
So while Kaio and Julian's principles are still valuable.
They are.
We need to expand our thinking to account for these new data-driven network effects.
Absolutely.
It's not just about connecting users anymore.
It's about harnessing the power of data.
Right. And that's a great takeaway from this paper and from our discussion. You know, it gives us this framework to understand the mechanics of platform competition.
Yeah.
But it's also like a springboard
mm-hmm.
for exploring these new dynamics that are shaping the digital landscape.
It really is. And that's what we hope to do on the deep dive, right?
Yeah, yeah.
To equip you, our listeners, with the knowledge to analyze, to question,
right,
to stay ahead of the curve in this rapidly evolving field.
Because the world of platforms, I mean, it's dynamic, it's constantly changing.
It really is.
But by understanding these core principles
mm-hmm.
and by recognizing how these new technologies are shaping the game,
right,
you can make more informed decisions, whether you're building a platform, investing in one, or just trying to make sense of what's going on.
Absolutely.
So as you continue your own deep dive into the platform economy, remember to challenge assumptions.
Yes.
Embrace new perspectives and never stop learning.
Because the only constant is change.
That's right. Thanks for joining us for another deep dive.
Thank you for listening to Talking About Platforms. In this special series on platform classics, we use AI to review and present published research, with intellectual property remaining with the original authors. Our goal is to make these insights accessible and encourage you to dive deeper into the original works. Stay tuned for more episodes and keep exploring the fascinating world of platforms.